I teach humanities and intellectual history at the University of Chicago. Persons have asked me what in the world intellectual history is. Many persons, I think, came here wondering what in the world the origins of secularism would be about. And I guess that just shows the unfortunate tendency of academics to think that they can't speak unless they use words of more than one syllable. And so I'll try to be clearer and less obscure about exactly what I'm going to talk about and exactly what I do as I proceed. I suppose the title of today's talk, discussion, might just as well have been, instead of the origins of secularism, something like the disappearance of the spirit in the modern world. What do I mean by the disappearance of the spirit? It's a close cognate phrase to something like the death of God, to something like secularity or secularism. And of course, I don't mean to suggest that somehow God has beaten a grand retreat around 1900 or anything of that sort. Phrases like secularism or the disappearance of the spirit refer instead to the fact that our culture, the world that we live in, is no longer shaped principally by spiritual or religious dimensions, that the formative influences upon our lives as we enter the world beyond the institutional church or the parochial school or our own Christian families turn out the major features of that world to be secular as opposed to Christian or religious or something of that sort. So that what I mean by the disappearance of the spirit is that the spirit, spiritual thing, a deep spiritual sense, sensibility, has gone from the lives of a huge number of men and women around and about us. So the problem today will be to reflect upon the nature of that. What exactly does this whole disappearance of the spirit entail? What does it mean for other human beings with whom we live and whom we know? But also to try to give some preliminary sense of just how this all came to pass. How did it come to happen over the past couple of centuries that what had been true, namely that most of Western Europe and the United States were cultures and nations who were deeply informed by, in terms of the way they thought about themselves, in terms of the way they thought about their own destiny, deeply shaped by spiritual values and religious values. How did it come to pass that we now live very much in a secular age? How did this all happen? What were the kinds of things that determined this monumental change? That's the kind of thing I'd like to reflect upon this morning. This is, of course, a vast subject, and if I were to be doing social history instead of intellectual history, which I'm going to be doing a little intellectual history this morning, I would worry about institutional church if I were doing social history. I would worry about the fact that this country, at least, in the modern period, that is, since about 1850, has been inundated with peoples from all over the globe, immigration of all sorts, have become a widely diversified society, how technology and urbanization and all of those words ending in T-I-O-N that intellectuals like to throw around, urbanization, immigration, etc., have shaped us, industrialization, and I would try to relate secularism to those kinds of things, the kinds of things that affect the way we relate to one another in societies and in institutions. But I'm not going to worry about that this morning. That's what a social historian would worry about as he looked to the past and focused upon those kinds of things, families, churches, schools, nation states, and so on. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to worry about the history of ideas, about the kinds of theories and concerns of the heart and of the mind that have received expression in philosophy and poetry and painting and music since around 1870, and during the 50 years, which I think is the crucial turning point in the growth of secularism, namely about 1870 to about 1920. If I had to say as a historian, when was the modern world born? The modern world being the world that we know, the world that we kind of inherit as a part of, though not as our total birthright, I would say it took place roughly during this period of extraordinary change in the thinking of the modern period. Let me see if I can give people a feeling for this period of 50 years just by mentioning some of the people who were writing and thinking during that time. Some of these names will mean nothing to you, but I'm sure that at least some of them will mean something to some of you. This was a period when the social sciences, as we now know them, anthropology, psychology, sociology, political science, were born as disciplines. They simply didn't exist in the form that we know them today prior to 1870. And the great fathers of these various sciences were people like Sigmund Freud, were people like Max Weber, were people like Emil Durkheim. So the social sciences as we now know them and understand them and read about them were born during this 50-year period. Simply were no such compartmentalized subjects prior to that. People worried about the same issues, but they were all lumped together under huge subjects like moral philosophy or something like that. In the world of philosophy, this was the period when philosophers like William James were writing, or philosophers like Henri Bergson, or like Bertrand Russell, or like G.E. Moore, etc. This was the great period of the novel. It was the period of the last great novels of Dostoevsky. Tolstoy lived through this entire period, died around 1918 at the very end of this period. So Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, the two great Russian novelists, came to the full fruition of their powers during this time. The German sort of philosopher, novelist, poet Nietzsche, one of the great adversaries of the Christian West, did his writing during the beginning of this period. Other novelists, Thomas Hardy, some of you might have read his bleak novels like Jude the Obscure and so on, were composed during these years. And we could go right on down, naming the great modern poets, Yeats, Eliot, Pound, Ezra Pound, or some of the great modern writers like Joyce, James Joyce, Marcel Proust. We could go on making a list of names. I mention them not because I'm going to talk about each of them individually or all of them collectively, but to kind of give us a feeling for where we are historically. We do the same with scientists. This is the period when Einstein announces the first general theory of relativity, when Max Planck and Niels Bohr do their work in atomic physics. So a lot is happening in virtually every field of intellectual endeavor. Indeed, a lot of fields of inquiry have just been born during this period, as in the social sciences. So there's a tremendous period of intellectual ferment. It's the time when the modern university, as we know it today, as a place of higher learning, as a place of inquiry, rather than the transmission of a past cultural tradition, but discovering new truth, is born. This is the time when really our universities as research institutions finally take off. Prior to 1870, there was nothing like a modern research institution in this country. Some of the same places existed. Harvard was founded already in the 17th century, but basically they were highly religious. They were basically involved in transmitting a religious and cultural tradition, in passing on old truths. The whole notion of research libraries, laboratories, and whatnot came about during this 50 years. So it's a period of extremely broad, extremely important intellectual change. What then is the precise nature of the disappearance of the spirit? What does it entail? First of all, let me give you some kind of descriptions of statements by some of these people, which I think capture the extraordinary sense of despair and loss and the retreat of spiritual values that many of these people felt deeply and lamented, even as they were kind of part of the process. I think one of the most famous statements comes early in the period from a great English poet named Matthew Arnold. Some of you, I think, probably have heard this poem. And if you don't recognize it by name, a few of the phrases, I think, will grab you, perhaps trigger dim recollections. The poem is Dover Beach. And the poem is about the kind of loss of Christian values and a firm sense of belief in England in the 1870s and 80s. Arnold does this in a poem, and I think it's a lovely poem, and so I want to give it to you as a first sample of a sense of growing secularity. The occasion for the poem is the speaker is obviously overlooking the beach at Dover in the evening, and one of the persons with him, a loved one, some woman, we're not told who. And first, the scene is painted. The speaker looks out over the beach and says, "The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay." Straight description. Then he summons the lover. "Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles, which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in." Okay, so he's asked the lover to join him now and called her attention to the place on the shore where the sea and the beach meet. And he's heard this ebb and flow of pebbles, the grating roar, as he calls it, and it's brought in a note of sadness. Why should that be? Well, first, the speaker is going to suggest that this is a sound that the world has heard from the beginning of culture, because then he says, Sophocles, long ago, the old Greek poet, wrote Oedipus Rex. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in that sound of thought, hearing it by this distant northern shore. Okay, so now the speaker has painted a scene, heard a sound, given us a feeling of sorrow, and unified that feeling of sorrow from the beginning of the Greek world up to the time that he is speaking. And now we suddenly get, why this sorrow? Why this sadness? What is the meaning of this sound? And we get the great simile, the great image or comparison on which the poem turns, and here it is. Because now he says, "The sea of faith was once too at the full, and lay round earth's shore like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating down the vast edges, drear, and naked shingles of the world." So now the sea has become an ocean of faith, which lay close around England, close around that shore to keep the country unified, to give it a kind of spiritual identity. And now the poet hears in his mind the retreat of the sea, and it suggests the retreat of the sea of faith, down the vast edges, drear, and naked shingles of the world. What does he do about it? In the face of this kind of spiritual emptiness, he turns to human love. He turns to the lover and then says, and here's how the poem ends, "Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world that seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." You catch in that poem, it seems to me, a tremendous sense of the feeling of loss. The world, neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. The loss of a sense of truth and stable, dependable reality. There's no help for pain, etc. This is the real lament that goes along with the birth of secularism. Arnold is kind of captured in this poem at the early part of our period. Okay, let's take another sample now. This at the very end of the period, this not by a poet, but by a philosopher, Bertrand Russell.
Russell, one of the few philosophers in the 20th century to have won the Nobel Prize, great logician, and led a very daring and exemplary life as a pacifist when it was not either very popular or very fashionable to be a pacifist during World War I in England, of all things, and a man of great courage, but a man who also contributed powerfully to the current of secularism, wrote a book called Why I Am Not a Christian. What is his picture of the world? Well, a quote now from Russell. Again, a very sober and serious and sad refrain. This is from Why I Am Not a Christian. Brief and powerless is man's life. On him and all his race, the slow, sure doom falls pitiless and dark. Blind to good and evil, reckless of destruction, omnipotent matter rolls on its relentless way. For man, condemned today to lose his dearest, tomorrow himself to pass through the gate of darkness, it remains only to cherish those lofty words, ere yet the blow falls, that ennoble his little day. Disdaining the coward terrors of the slave of fate, to worship at the shrine that his own hands have built. Undismayed by the empire of chance, to preserve a mind free from the tyrannies that rule his outward life. Proudly defiant of the irresistible forces that tolerate for a moment his knowledge and his condemnation, to sustain alone a tired but unyielding atlas, the world that his own ideals have fashioned, despite the trampling marches of unconscious power. A kind of grim, and despairing view. Man is like an atlas sustaining a world that he has invented, that he has made, that he has created out of thin air, spun out of nothing, to provide a kind of temporary consolation to the pains that beset him. Here is a philosopher who believes that there simply are no ultimate spiritual truths, and that that kind of source of light has gone out forever in the world. One final comment, one final quote, this one I promise will be shorter. This from Max Weber, the great founder of the discipline of sociology, a man who came from a home with very devout parents who, after undergoing a nervous breakdown at the turn of the 20th century, wrote The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, his most famous book, where he linked Protestantism and its spiritual values to the rise of capitalist form of economics. And he's giving his last address, 1919, a year before he dies, and standing before a group of his own students in Germany. And he titles the address, Science as a Vocation. And his little one sentence in there, and he's obviously deeply struggled by the truth of what he's saying, even though he embraces that which he in some ways despises. He says, we have seen in our own time the increasing rationalization and intellectualization of all of life. And this is nothing less than the disenchantment of the world. That is, the disappearance of mystery, the presence of science and reason, and those forces emptying out the tender and serious things of our lives and substituting hard scientific explanations for them. Okay, that's a sample of the kind of lament that we hear roundabout during this 50-year period. That went hand in hand with the growth of secularism. That gives us a sense of what it entailed, its depths of sorrow and melancholy, its overtones of despair, at the same time courage in facing up to the world without these consolations. But that gets us deeply into the question, how did this all come to pass? What in the world came about that made intellectuals in droves begin to abandon, even though it pained them, the Christian or religious, because Christianity is one type of religion, but any kind of religious consolation. What when the world prompted them to do this? I want to suggest three things that prompted them to do this. Three things which I think, and this gets in a way to the point of why we should spend an hour listening to these grim prophecies, which I think touch each one of us, because at some time or another during our own lives, we are stricken by doubts and anxieties and turmoils of one kind or another, And here these intellectuals do us a great service because they give voice and analysis to these doubts that sometimes in us are inchoate, that is unformed. We can't get a hold of them. We just feel a kind of vague malaise and distress and uncertainty. So by mentioning these three things and talking about them a bit, I think we can pretty much relate each of us to him and herself times when we've faced the same issues personally. Okay, so what are the three then major contributing elements to secularity or to the disappearance of spirit? The first one I would put, and here again I'm going to exhibit my tendency to always have some word up here that ends in ISM, because I'm going to call it science and scientism. Science and scientism. Well, science has been around for a long time. It didn't just start in 1870 and go on from there to 1920. It started as old as thought itself, science, knowledge. So there must be something peculiar about the science or unusual about the kind of science practiced in the 19th century to warrant this as a kind of reason for secularity. I think the commanding figure of the 19th century in science is, of course, Charles Darwin, just as Sir Isaac Newton was the commanding figure in the 18th century. Newton was to physics what Darwin was to biology. When Darwin discovered the theory of evolution, he not only posed a tremendous threat, or his theory posed a tremendous threat, to persons who believed in a kind of six-day creation. Most of us think of the Darwin struggle principally as a kind of overly caricatured battle between pious clergymen on the one hand and evil scientists on the other, with the clergyman quoting Genesis and the scientist saying evolution and everyone getting upset over this. This is the caricature of the 19th century because, as a matter of fact, the struggle over Darwinism really was vastly more intricate on that particular front. And Darwin's whole... The struggle that Darwinian biology, evolutionary biology, posed to any kind of spiritual values was much deeper, really, than simply the notion of challenging the Genesis account of the origins of the world. Much deeper. Because here's what Darwinism did. Everyone who had found meaning and purpose in their lives on the grounds that the changes over history that had taken place were the result of some imminent plan or end or purpose, or goal. Every person who felt a part of something larger than him or herself as a part of a community, whether a Christian community or not, because history or the development of change over time was the result of imminent plan or purpose, now had that shattered because here comes Darwin, and what Darwin says is all of these changes, which men have explained for years in terms of goals and ends and purposes, are really the result of a kind of mechanism of chance. That is, what happens is you have these species, you have too many members of a given species and a scarcity of food, you have a struggle within species to survive. The ones that do survive are the ones that then procreate, and through this principle of natural selection, he called it, natural selection, there is immense change over time in the whole animal world, including human beings. So what is thought of as a grand design, a grand plan with an end or a goal, is now reduced to a kind of random collection of forces and struggles which eventuate in something that men, because of their own value dispositions, want to call progress. This is to kind of pull the plug out from a lot of deep belief in imminent providence. Because now we're shown a mechanism that works mindlessly. There's no intelligence guiding this, seemingly. And it results just in struggle among species, the survival of the fittest, the procreation of that species, and on, okay? So this was the challenge of Darwinian biology and science. But it wasn't nearly as great as this whole second word here, scientism. What did scientism mean? I mean, why put another word up there ending in ISM? What people began increasingly to claim in the 19th century was that every aspect of human experience, our emotional life, our psychological life, our spiritual life, our social life, could now be explained, could now be reduced to explanations just like the explanations given by natural scientists for physics and biology. What does that mean? Well, it means simply that men came to be regarded as just more complicated stones and plants. Men were finally a more intricate machine, but only more intricate than a stone or a plant. And that the same things, the same kind of principles that scientists use to explain plants and rocks would do just as well for human beings as soon as their intricacy was fully discovered and explained. And most of you, even though this seems terribly abstract, know what I mean, because the growth of these very social scientists, like psychology, like anthropology, and like sociology, typically when we have a problem, we have deep feelings of despair, joy, whatnot, people will say, well, let me explain to you why that is. Here's the theory. It either has to do with toilet training, and if we really do enough analysis, we can get down to the roots of some kind of conflict here that went on between you and your stepmother at age 2, and that's now why you're feeling depressed. And here's the theory, and I'll explain it to you in these terms. Or we hear from a sociologist, well, now look, folks, why do you believe in X? Well, let's see, what ethnic group do you come from? Yes, and furthermore, you now live in where? Minnesota? I see. Minnesota, of Scandinavian origin, came to this country, your forebears, in what, 1880s, 1890s maybe? Yes, that figures. This is your sociological group. This is your historical inheritance. This is your age. This is your ethnic background. This is your belief system. It's all a part and parcel of that. So why do you believe X? Because of this kind of sociological truth about you, this theory. Why do you feel Y? Well, because if you didn't get along with your stepmother at age 2 and you're still suffering over this. So we need specialists and experts and ologists of all kinds to explain ourselves to ourselves. Let's not have any of this nonsense of referring to, the intellectuals would say, supernatural forces. We can get right down to the hard pine of science and come up with a theory, and that'll wrap it all up. Okay? Now, this whole notion that every part of our life, there was no kind of sacred part, no special part that was really mysterious and involved belief and meaning and value that was genuine and that had a kind of sanction outside of this earth. There was always some room for that up until about 1870, 1920, when suddenly everything fell open to these kinds of explanations. That's what I mean by scientism. Scientism is the encroachment of scientific method on every part of human life and thought, okay? And as I say, this is not a matter for just intellectuals who live off in the academy and kind of look anemic because they haven't seen the sun for a week and rummage around in old dusty books and use big words ending in ism. This is not just those people's problems. It's the kind of thing we run into, but it's built now into the fabric of our culture, and we can't escape it. It's there. I can tell by people's giggles that you've all run into this in some form or another. I can tell that this isn't something that only a few people run into, and that's just testimony of the secularity of our culture. Okay, science and scientism was only number one. Number two, and here again we have a nice symmetry because we're going to write two words down. The second one's going to end in ISM. History and historicism. I can see everyone going back and saying, well, this fellow's a college teacher and it figures because he made fun of using words ending in ISM, but he still couldn't get around it. Okay, history and historicism. The 19th century is the great century of history. Did history just... The growth of history as a specialized academic discipline is really a 19th century phenomenon. And that changes things once history becomes this way, profoundly. How? And how does it relate to the growth of secularity? For one thing, Just as nothing became exempt from scientific scrutiny and scientism, so now nothing became exempt from historical criticism. And most of us are familiar with the fact that now the scriptures in the 19th century, as texts, are subjected to exactly the same critical method. Some of us call this the higher criticism. Some of us call it the lower criticism. Subjected to the same kinds of historical and literary critical methods as any other text. And suddenly, passages from Scripture are interpreted according to their particular historical context, the particular audience to which they were addressed. Other books are found to be dubious in terms of authorship. Perhaps they had two or three authors rather than one, etc., etc. I don't think I need to tell this audience too much more about that facet of the growth of history as a specialized discipline and its impact upon sacred texts. Now notice, the Bible is not the only sacred text that undergoes this. I mean, the same thing is done with the Quran and other texts for the other great world religions. This doesn't just happen to Christianity. It's a crisis that all of the major world religions face. And that's important to remember, lest we think that this is some kind of conspiracy by professional historians directed against just Christianity or something of that sort. Okay, but that only skims the surface of the challenge of history. Historians also now, once they're professionally trained, begin to look seriously with a kind of objective and dispassionate eye at the whole history of the world religions. How did people who professed this or that behave? What are we going to do about three people all claiming to be Pope at the same time? What are we going to do about the fact that the English Reformation was spearheaded by certain of Henry VIII's sexual appetites? What do we do about the fact that in the name of various high religious callings, people slaughtered one another by the thousands throughout a world history? In other words, the whole history of religious, world religious practice began to be examined with a highly critical and demythologizing eye on the part of the professional historian. But that only skims the surface. It seems to me that the higher criticism in that point are easy enough to deal with. One can, though one's initially distressed, nonetheless, it seems to me this doesn't lead directly to secularism of any sort, though it may and has for some people. The third thing gets into the word historicism. What could this mean? Historicism is a kind of word that comes about after the practice of history professionally is well underway, and it holds the following. Historicism is the view that each and every historical period is a kind of self-contained unity of values, of religious systems, of cultural practices, of social habits, and that each one has a kind of inner principle of unity, and successive ones can understand those earlier ones only through tremendous leaps of the imagination. If we can kind of leap and imagine what it was like to be a 5th century Athenian. That means, basically, that everyone lives, though on the same planet, in nonetheless a fundamentally different world from people who lived in earlier historical times. It's not just that people 100 or 200 years ago had this or that different opinion. It's that when they woke up and looked at the world as feeling and thinking and worshiping beings, they had a whole different sense of the way that world worked. What do I mean? Well, think of people prior to the 17th century who genuinely believed that the earth was the center of the solar system. And because the earth was the center and man was the most important creature on the earth, the whole universe was kind of anthropocentric, just in the way the planets were put together. Well, you can tell the impact of the fact that the earth is not the center of our solar system and is a kind of puny little body out on the edge of the Milky Way, this is going to reorient one's sense of one's own locale in the universe, spatially. Okay, we could go on and on. What about people who are animistic and who believe that all of nature is populated with spirits? Or people who believe, for example, that the millennium is going to happen 2 years hence? They feel and think and act and evaluate and judge and have children or not, and have different toilet habits or not, vastly differently from people in other historical periods. Now, there are some lines of continuity, to be sure, but the emphasis that the historicist makes is that every period is fundamentally different from every other. Fine. What does that have to do with secularity? Well, you can see very quickly that as long as you start now making the claim that all historical periods are different, you suddenly begin to relativize or make relative to just a particular period any belief system. So that, for example, it's all well and good for the X people to have believed Y and Z, but we, living in the Y period, can't possibly believe Y and Z because Y and Z were really for the X period. They went together with that universe, with that sense of physics, with that sense of biology, with that sense of human destiny, with that notion of what art was. Art, some people thought, was just a representation of reality. Art, other periods thought, was something altogether different. So on any major issue of human thought or feeling, you could find vast differences in other historical periods. And this was to open up the past in a way that it had never been opened up before, when people really thought that 5th century Greeks were just really 20th century Americans who wore funny togas, but that was really all the difference, and that the clothing of different civilizations, the surface appearance, was all that made them different. This historicism was to say their whole worldviews were different, so different that they really lived in a different world, but on the same planet. And that's to make everything relative. And all the absolute certainties that tend to be true at all times and in all places and for all peoples turned out to simply be historically proven to be false. That simply wasn't true, that there are certain truths that were true at all times for all people and in all places. And this made everyone, for reasons I think you can intuit, very nervous about spirituality that claimed to be trans-historical and transcendent. And now I'm going to prove a certain consistency, because my third reason is also going to end in ISM, and it's going to be called cultural relativism. Okay? Cultural relativism is going to be simple to explain, because all it is historicism, except that instead of looking backwards through time, it's to look all around the globe at any given time. Okay? It's the discovery by the 19th century West of other cultures in all of their depth and complexity. Other cultures living at the same time. And what do people do in the 19th century? Well, it's really the first time that a mass audience, which is now increasingly literate, has access to print and so on, finds out just truths about the way people live elsewhere. Herman Melville, one of our greatest novelists, what were his best sellers? Moby Dick? No. Billy Budd? No. Typee and Umu. Who's heard of Typee and Umu? Not very many people. If you do crossword puzzles, you often run into Umu. It's O-M-O-O. But apart from running into it in crossword puzzles, where do people run into the title? They don't. But it's a clue to understanding the 19th century fascination. What are they about? Melville's adventures in the South Seas. There's thinly veiled, fictionalized accounts of Melville's experience when he jumped ship, was captured by a kind of primitive tribe, held captive for 2 months over in the South Pacific. How he then got back on a ship, became a beachcomber for a while. People lapped these books up like mad. Both his publisher in London and in America went wild because he was selling millions of books. And then he wrote this crazy thing about a whale, and people said, oh, this is never going to work. Terrible book. Write some more adventure about the South Sea. The point is that that's an index to how hungry people were for travel literature, learning about other people, just getting the raw data of how other people at the same time in different places live. What do they worship? What do they eat? What do they wear? What are their sexual practices like? How do they raise their children? What's the climate like? What, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This hunger for information, this astonishing sense that one is on a planet and is really culturally and religiously in a kind of minority, that other persons have not heard of Western religion, much less Western technology and whatever. Most of our major novelists during this period, Mark Twain, Henry James, all began writing travel sketches for magazines, the Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, and so on, that simply reported back to this country their various travels through the Holy Land, through Egypt, through Africa. And you can see, I think, that they get, if you read some of their later novels, their training in playing off one culture and against another, putting a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, or putting an American innocent like Daisy Miller over in Europe, or putting Strether, who is a leading character in The Ambassadors of Henry James, over in Europe. Placing people from one culture into others and watching how they behave is a kind of standard thing in American literature, and it begins with his great fascination about other cultures. Okay, that's to say that we were, as a society, concerned about it. And of course, the academics got a hold of this and began sending out field workers and anthropologists and sociologists to weigh and measure and observe and study and whatnot. Just before coming here, I dropped a friend of mine who's working at the University of Chicago in anthropology off on a trip which I told him I wouldn't have the courage to make. He's going out to the wilds of New Guinea. He's flying there, and then he takes a boat trip from the port out to a small mail outpost, and then he hikes in 15 miles into the interior, meets a tribal chieftain who takes him off to a village, and he lives there for 14 months. No mail, no American food, no radio, no television, no nothing. By himself, in a hut with these people. 14 months. No newspaper, no baseball scores. I would draw the line there. And this is extraordinary that someone could do this. It's more courage than I have, frankly. The point is that during this period, this kind of thing starts. And people are positively stunned by the enormous diversity in the world. It occurs to people very soon, and this gets now back to spirituality, religiosity. It occurs to them, well, now what about any religion that makes a kind of exclusive claim to embodying a belief system that is the only way to whatever, happiness, salvation, etc. What about the millions upon millions of human beings who have lived upon the face of the earth and have never heard either the Quran or the scriptures or whatever? Because all religions worry about this the same way. What are we going to do about this cultural relativism? Are we seriously going to argue? Are we seriously going to argue that all of these people are in some sense either unhappy or damned or forever lost? What do we make of this? This problem sunk in a way that I think still haunts the 20th century, about, on the one hand, religious doctrine of different kinds wants to make exclusive claims, I am the way, or this book is the truth, or whatnot, and 99.44% of the globe over the historical time, and now throughout different cultures, have simply never heard that word, and never will, and will go to their graves ignorant of it, but who had richly religious lives of their own, richly moral lives of their own, richly cultural lives of their own, in their own terms. Okay, so we have science and scientism, history and historicism, and we have culture, cultural relativism. These are very much with us today. If one goes to any university, learns any discipline of the social sciences or the humanities, one's going to run into the impact of these various views of the world. And of course, each one of them contains different sorts of threats to, challenges to, weakenings of certain sorts of spiritual values along the lines I've suggested. That plugs back into something of what we thought the other night. Here we had, I think you were the one who was talking about certain of the values that your children were raised with, or that you were raised with, and how this generation, because of new facts like the pill, or like IUDs, or like the availability of abortion, or like whatever, because they live with these things that previous generations just didn't know, their ethical system, their notion, their sense of priorities and values changes just because they're living with things that their predecessors did not live with, enjoying a confusing welter of freedoms that another generation didn't know. Well, this is to engage in a kind of historicism. It's to be shocked by the extraordinary discontinuities, not now over 100-year periods, but for Pete's sake, over generations. And one of the great burdens of modernity, one of the things that we live with that no previous generation ever lived with, is the increasing velocity of history. And I would kind of add that together to these three. That is, the speed of historical change is ever accelerating. So that changes that perhaps took 500 years at one time now are over in three or four. And so we are kind of, this is kind of part of what Tefler calls future shock. This inability to get our historical bearings before the whole ground gives way from under us and we're facing new problems. I face problems that my parents didn't imagine. My children will face problems that won't occur to me ever. And this is to venture into a kind of historicist view of how each generation is really different. The way they think of themselves, the way they think of the world, the way they think of spirituality, etc., etc. Okay, I'm going to make just a couple quick summary remarks and a few closing reflections, and then we can talk about these things because they're confusing and powerful and puzzling. Let me say that what I didn't do this morning quite deliberately was to give some kind of Christian apologetic, that is, defense or response to each of these three things. I didn't do that deliberately because I feel like my aim was to try to give whoever showed today a sense of where persons who are not reared within and or who do not still hold to a certain set of religious values, where they got their own beliefs and what those beliefs are and how they threaten Christianity. Since this so much shapes our culture, these kinds of things, I wanted to try to give us a sense of the roots of those things and leave it open to conversation to engage in dialogue between various spiritual values and these various positions. So I left that out on purpose, not because I somehow am an apologist for or a representative of or a deep believer in secularity and I want to give three cheers for it. My task is simply to lead us to understand where it came from, not to endorse it or to applaud it or anything like that. So that's one summary remark. The next summary remark is that one thing we often do with folks like Freud or Weber or Yeats or any number of the names that I mentioned earlier is to dismiss them, or Nietzsche, is to dismiss them too quickly as somehow blasphemous adversaries of the Christian or of all faith. And therefore we set them aside. We don't have to deal with them. I would argue, and I won't take the time to develop it here, but if you want to ask some questions on it, I would argue. But part of the reason these people wound up sounding like the speaker in the Arnold poem that I read, or Bertrand Russell, or some of Nietzsche's strongest and shrillest attacks on Christian values, is because in a way they took Christianity as deeply, if not more deeply seriously, in trying to reckon with what it really demanded of one than some Christians. That is, they wanted, if they were to embrace a spiritual system, to embrace it all the way, to live life in such a way, as the great cardinal said when he asked, what is a Christian? He said, to be a Christian is to live your life in such a way that it would not make sense if God did not exist. To live your life in such a way that it would not make sense if God did not exist. And I think a number of these people who wind up as spokesmen for secularism deeply believe that that is what Christianity called them to do if they were to be Christians. Or you can fill in the blank. You can talk about Hinduism or Buddhism or whatnot, because they came from diverse traditions. And part of the reason there's such a lament, such a deep sorrow, in the tone of voice you heard in the poem Dover Beach, in the quote from Bertrand Russell, and in Max Weber's ringing speech in Sciences of Vocation, is that these people feel the pull and the need for spiritual values so deeply that rather than to reject them wholesale, what they wind up doing is rejecting their own tradition, only to reinstate and relocate and refurbish spiritual values elsewhere. Many of them do it in art. Many of them say that art now is the place for the realization, expression and interpretation of what it means to be fully spiritual. That's the creative domain of human beings. That's where someone makes something that's temporary but that's somehow eternal because there's an eternal form, be it an urn or a painting or a statue. And so most of these people crave spirituality, feel the spiritual emptiness as deeply as you and I intermittently feel it, because all of us are overcome with great doubt. All of us ask these questions. How did I come to believe what I do? What if I had been born in Ceylon? What if I had been born in 4th century Tasmania? These questions ring in upon us often. So what I'm proposing, I guess, is an alliance through understanding of where these people have come from and what they have said and what burdens they've borne, what agonies they shared, rather than to simply write them off as prophets of disaster, people who have announced that God is dead, people who are responsible somehow for the disappearance of the spirit in the modern world, or in modern culture, as that culture is informed by the ideas that I explained this morning.